From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sooner or later, it happens to nearly everyone. We look up one day and find we are channeling our parents. In some way, great or small, becoming them. For New Yorker writer and literary critic James Wood, it happened in his 40s. As he settled into middle age, he also found himself settling into habits of his father. It was part welcome, part eerie, and maybe inevitable. This hour On Point, seeing our parents in ourselves. You can join the conversation. Has it happened to you? Where? When? How? Do you have the feeling you've become in some way your mother, your father? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is James Wood, literary critic, essayist, novelist. He's a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine. His essay, the essay in this in the latest issue, is Becoming Them, Our Parents, Ourselves. James Wood, it's such a pleasure to have you right here in the studio. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So a little Beethoven who began to take you back into your father's slippers or armchair or you into practically the mind of him.
Yeah, I've been having that experience that I think is common to many people in their late 30s and 40s. It begins to creep up on you. And it was, for me, it was centered around classical music. I was listening more and more to Beethoven, a composer I used to very foolishly dismiss when I was a teenager, because the whole experience of listening to Beethoven was so bound up with family memories of my father listening to Beethoven, Haydn, Schubert on Sunday afternoons. It was a family ritual. He would make lunch. Mm-hmm. He would collapse in the armchair, put on, say, a Haydn string quartet or a Beethoven piano sonata, and the rest of us would go to sleep or try to escape in some some way.
Yes.
So it took me a very long time to get over a childish resistance to these marvelous composers, in particular to Beethoven.
You see, Haydn was killed for me. No more Moonlight Sonata from Beethoven, please.
And I had, I had to make my own discovery. And Beethoven did come back properly for me in my 20s, came rushing back, and I explored every nook and cranny. But I think it wasn't until 10 or 15 years later, I can precisely remember the moment I was listening to the slow movement of a Beethoven string quartet, mm-hmm. and I suddenly thought, it took me instantly back to those Sunday afternoons, and I suddenly thought, I have become my father.
And at that moment, you say you felt a combination of satisfaction and still rebellion all at once.
Yeah, I think it's inevitably mixed, isn't it? And one of the things I was trying to write about in this piece was to push in some ways the banality of that feeling. We all experience mm-hmm. it. We probably all experience this mixed apprehension. But to push that a little bit towards perhaps the deeper themes of anxiety, and how in becoming our parents we are inevitably in some way outgrowing them. In other words, in order for us to become them, they have to die, effectively. I think that is the awful experience, isn't it, of middle age, which is not just, oh, I'm like my dad, I'm like my mom. Mm-hmm. I'm like them as they were when I was a child. And therefore, my moment as mm-hmm. parent has come, mm-hmm. and my moment to outlive and outgrow them and for them to die is also upon me. That's the anxiety I was trying to get at in the piece.
The anxiety of mortality, that's also kind of a co-realization of that sense of having become them.
Yeah.
Also, though, there is the death, or at least the little death, of our sense of pride in originality. I mean, you write this wonderful phrase, that you said you were dismayed by the plagiarism of inheritance. Our very lives as a piece of, in some way, plagiarism of our parents.
Yeah. Doesn't it take about 20 years for us to realize how much of our life is written for us? I'm always trying to, you know, I teach quite a bit, and when I'm teaching undergraduates, mm-hmm. They get a great deal of literature swiftly, but one of the things it's hardest often to give them a sense of is that literature is powerfully about lives being determined, and that actually, you know, life at 20 looks as if it's full of potential, and life at 40.
Here we go, anywhere we like, whatever we want.
Life at 40, you can see what was written for you and how little freedom actually you had in that small window. This is getting awfully depressing, but you know what I mean.
No, it's just life. It's just a fact.
It is that way. And I should also say that this piece came out of again, fairly typical, but a difficult last two or three years.
Your wife losing both of her parents. You're still alive.
Yeah, mine is still alive. They're in their mid-80s and hanging in there. But my father-in-law died in 2010. My mother-in-law died a few months ago. And I would often say to my wife, I can almost be there with you, except that it isn't happening to me. And so I can't. There's some final separation between you and me. And she would say, inevitably, that's true, but in time it will happen to you too, and then I will be with you. And part of this awfulness of having, you know, aging parents is I think preparing for mourning them, which is to say you are mourning them before they are dead. You know, in some ways, what it will be like. Maybe you live with someone who's lost their parents, but even imaginatively, you. Things are beginning to wind down, as it were.
I mean, that's there. But, I mean, you write, and many experience first, perhaps when they're still quite vigorous. Maybe they're in their, you know, who knows, 50s or 60s, that 20 or 30-year-old child can begin to feel that. I mean, you say, you know, I like that my voice is exactly the same pitch as my father's and can be mistaken for it. You know, you hear yourself speaking to your children, and it's just as he spoke to you. You write, sometimes when I'm sitting doing nothing, I have the eerie sense that my mouth and eyes are set just like his. I mean, well before the precipice, well before the great beyond, it can come on, this sense of, I thought I was an independent actor in the universe, and whoa, once again, it's proven, as all literature shows us, that there's this great chain of being. Yes. We're sort of stuck in it. But we can be stuck in it in opposition, in antithesis, as much as plagiarism. I mean, what about that balance?
Yeah, I think, isn't it, that's the great irony, is finding out that even in rebellion, you are much more like your parents than you think you are. And I think, you know, literature gives us examples of figures who, in their very stubbornness, in their stubborn rebellion, may actually resemble, say, the stubborn conformity, which actually was rebellion 50 years earlier, of their parents. There's a wonderful novel by Marilyn Robinson, Home, which is about a prodigal son coming back to the household of his father, who's a minister, and. Formally, officially, the minister rejects him. But actually, they're much more like each other in their stubbornness, the prodigal son and the minister, than each can recognize.
Which means that even in that rebellion against the parent, there may be the seed of that similarity, or the framework of a similarity, even there.
Yes.
I don't know, as time goes on, I mean, you write that you came to understand that the father you had become, your father that you'd become, yes, indeed you may have, but it was your father of your youth, not necessarily even the man who's there now. So you'd become him at the moment of his fullness as a parent, I guess, not a grandparent or an elder.
Yes. I didn't realize that until this last year when my father got ill and went to hospital, and I went over to look after my mum. And I suddenly realized when my father came back from hospital that it took me a few days to realize it, but I suddenly realized that the house was without music.
Where's the Beethoven?
And I said to my dad, you know, I don't see you listening to Schubert and Beethoven anymore. And he said, oh, well, quite cheerfully, he said, no, the CD player's been broken for a couple of years.
But no big deal to
you. But no big deal.
Now.
And it was such a big deal to me, because clearly I had so much invested in the idea of my father frozen in that posture of parenthood. Mm-hmm. I think there's a great deal of protection, isn't there, in how we freeze these images. However much we say we don't like them, of course,
yes,
there's so much love bound up with the with the disdain. More love, I think, than disdain. Mm-hmm. So we invest a great deal in these pictures of childhood, which protect us, I think. And I wanted my father to be the same person at 84 as he was at 48. And of course he wasn't. He's changing. It isn't so important to him that he listens to music. He's an old man. He's looking after my wife, my mother. Mm-hmm. His priorities have changed.
We become a version of our parents even as they perhaps move on. James Wood is with us, literary critic, essayist, novelist. Wonderful essay in The New Yorker called Becoming Them, Our Parents, Ourselves this week. Little Prince, When Doves Cry. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about that sense we all or most get sometime. My gosh, I'm turning into my parents, my mother, my father, the way they are or were. James Wood is with us, literary critic, essayist, novelist, staff writer for The New Yorker. His wonderful essay in this week's edition is Becoming Them, Our Parents, Ourselves. James Wood joins me in the studio, and we've got wonderful feedback from our listeners here. One reminds us of the great Mark Twain quote. T.F. writes, Mark Twain wrote, when I was 14, I thought my father was the most ignorant old coot ever to walk the earth. When I turned 21, it amazed me how much he'd learned in the last 7 years. We asked online if people were worried about turning into their parents. Jean says, more like them every day, and she doesn't seem too worried about that. Charles says, will I become like my parents? No, I never will. That's not the way he wants to go. On the other hand, here Gary writes, he says, I'm turning into my father and I know it. The thing is, I wholly welcome it. My dad's a pretty great guy. I find the only things I dislike about my father's demeanor, I've substituted in my own personality with the softer characteristics of my mother. I realize I am the proverbial yin-yang of both my parents' personalities, and I do not resent this. I relish it. What about that resentment and relishing ratio, James?
That's great. These are such personal narratives. Mm-hmm. My own has to do with growing up in a quite religious, sort of Christian, even evangelical upbringing. So
in Scotland,
My dad decided, he was a zoologist, but he decided to get ordained in his 50s and become a priest.
Something you have not yet done, though.
No.
Who knows?
So, and this is where it's very personal. For I would say the first 25 years of my life, the set of my narrative, as I understood it, was rebellion, because mm-hmm. it was about rejection of my parents' Christianity. Mm-hmm. That hasn't changed. You find in, obviously, historically and in literature, these motifs come back again and again when it comes to religious households of people mm-hmm. needing to. It's one of escape. You need to, if you don't share your parents' belief, you fight them, you escape, you break away. That was how it was for me, and there's still a rift, big rift between me and on that particular front.
But it's funny how that hasn't kept you from feeling that you're in your father's shoes or slippers.
No.
Even so, it's some way more fundamental than that expression.
Exactly. And I think that's why with peculiar force, the countervailing apprehension that actually I was much more like them than I'd ever really admitted came back. It came back with particular force because I'd constructed a narrative of escape and rebellion and difference.
So all the more arresting when suddenly there you are putting
indeed.
On the Heidenor.
Indeed. Okay. And that's, I think, your callers were saying this, that actually you can indeed live a life in which pragmatically and and intentionally, you do things very differently from your parents. You may raise your children mm-hmm. differently, you mm-hmm. have different beliefs and so on. But somehow there's this creeping genetic inheritance. Just think about it physically. You know, you begin, you look at photographs and you're just astounded. Of course, sometimes it goes back a generation and you think it's not so much your mother or father, mm-hmm. but actually a grandparent mm-hmm. that you look strikingly, mm-hmm. you strikingly resemble.
You may look like them, yeah, you may walk like them, you may speak like
them. People you perhaps never really knew very well.
Let's bring our listeners in. Melanie in Columbia, South Carolina. Melanie, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah. What do you think?
I just have a comment. As a drama therapist, I take the view that everyone adopts pieces of roles around them. We just have a lot more material from our parents.
Yes,
and that
yes.
health is kind of demonstrated by your ability to identify and accept the wise parts, the mature parts of your parents as roles within yourself to use when you need.
Are we capable of knowing what the wise parts are? Do we see that clearly, or do we get all the baggage whether we want it or not? Melanie, what do you think?
Oh, it's so complicated as a therapist, you can imagine. But I think that, you know, some people have extraordinarily disruptive and damaging parents, and some people have parents with a mixture, and it's part of our learning, our life learning, to determine what is healthy and what is useful. But the key to health is the spontaneity, the flexibility to identify some behaviors might be useful in the moment, but not useful at other times.
A drama therapist seeing us picking up bits and pieces of roles from all over, and of course, parents as our first role models. Melanie, thanks for that. One more, Ashley. Ashley, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
My mother was 21 years old when she had me, and I'm 26 now, and I don't have any children. She was a single parent, and I was the only child.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself as a teenager becoming really annoyed with a lot of the ways that she does things, like either being really obsessed with fitness or actually being extremely sedentary, and also that she's rather a snap judge of character. And I always thought that was a really terrible thing to do, and that there were all these extremes about her that were alarming to me and kind of repulsive. And although I love my mother greatly, and at 26, even though I've made it a point to live a completely different life, I have a higher education than she ever did,
mm-hmm.
And I've stayed single, I haven't had any children, I find myself going through these very similar phases that she does, where I'm either really into fitness and I work out obsessively every day, or maybe I don't and I sit around all day for several weeks, or... I also became obsessed with learning a language in the same way that she did, but instead of studying German, I wound up studying Spanish, and I guess that was the rebellious part.
How rebellious, Spanish over German. But when you feel when you feel bits of her coming out in yourself, do you embrace them? Do you think it's inevitable? Do you feel imprisoned or empowered, Ashley?
Sometimes I feel imprisoned. One thing about my mother, though, is that she was always very beautiful and very graceful.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching her get ready for work in the morning, just sort of sitting around in the bathroom, watching her do her makeup and put her lotion on and everything.
Sure.
And I find myself making the same expressions in the mirror, the makeup face is what I call it, is this funny puckered face that she makes when she's putting her makeup on. I find myself do it, and I actually feel very sweetly endeared to her at that time.
Your mother almost literally looking back at you in the mirror. That's a great image, Ashley. I appreciate your call. James Woods, stand by with us for a second in the studio here. With us right now from Atlanta, Georgia, is Vanessa Jackson. She's a clinical social worker, does a lot of research on power within families, we have found a wise eye and mind on a lot of these things. Vanessa Jackson, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Great to be back. And I'm just loving this conversation. the thought that came to me was a line I heard at a therapy conference about 25 years ago, which I didn't really appreciate at the time, which was the word matrophobia by Sandra Butler. And she goes, that's not fear of your mother, that's fear of becoming your mother.
Matrophobia. And yet, I don't know what you find in the people you work with, Vanessa, or in yourself. I mean, when it comes, it can feel inevitable. It can, it, my experience has been that it can produce a sense of compassion for parents that one might not have had as a child. But when you feel some of their character emerging in yourself, you understand it from the inside out a little better.
Absolutely. And I think that at 25, I could get to with the horror of becoming my mother. And I think at 52, I now appreciate all the ways I'm like her and beginning to grow into how I'm like my father as well. Because, you know, I think it's oftentimes at different marker points you start to see where it's a little bit okay to be like them. And I think those are the times when we feel most in our own power. If I'm graduating from high school, I can be able to have a little bit more room to reflect on my parents and the positives about them. When people become parents, they can start to have a little bit more flexibility around that. But I think it's really when we slide into our 30s and 40s, when we sort of establish ourselves in the world, that we can really open up to the complexity and including the wonderful parts of our parents. I look at my hands sometimes, and the first time I looked down, I thought, oh, my God, I have my mother's hands. Like, where did these come from?
Yeah. We first respond, you know, to their authority maybe as kids, and we think of that as their power.
Right.
But it seems to me, Vanessa, James, that as we grow, we see not their authority so much as just the stark model. They're modeled. We are modeled, you know, genetically and in our behavior on them. They are our first models, Vanessa.
I think absolutely. And when you can get in your own power, and I think that's an important word, when I know who I am, I have a lot more flexibility, in fact, to sort of begin to think about the things that got me to this place. There's a African proverb that I use a lot is, because you are, I am. And that's at the most base sort of biological level, but also the things that they open up, the ways that they lift us up. And sometimes that's the very things that we critique, that if they had only known more, then we wouldn't have so far to climb. But also understanding that their job is to lift us up a little bit higher, and then we need to scramble up the rest ourselves, and we're going to be lifting other people up. And I think when we start to have a little bit more compassion for that, it frees everybody up. And then you have the other side of it, which is, you know, as James talked about, watching them change and watching them age is humbling and terrifying.
It certainly opens our eyes to life, to what's coming. I mean, James Wood, what about this balance of there's a kind of balance of freedom and bondage here, right? And I wonder what you found. I'm reading in an essay, it was somebody who's writing about his father who had passed on as a posthumous puppet master, you know, still on the strings of his father's character, his father's personality. What about that combination in your case, James, did you find?
The bondage is a serious thing. I mean, that you do feel that sense of imprisonment that we've talked about, which can be very uneasy, even at the physical level of, wow, these aren't my hands, or these gestures are my mother's gestures, or whatever. Maybe one small silver lining of the general awfulness of getting older and watching one's parents grow older is that there's a slight loosening of the sense of the bonds, because you talked about, you know, parents having power.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously have a lot less power when they're older. They become they are preparing themselves for the end.
And we've been exposed to more models over time, more options.
Yeah, and they're weaker, and they're focused on their survival. Mm-hmm. They're less engaged in that irritating, authoritative relationship that they had perhaps when you were younger. And so then your role changes somewhat too, and I think you can find some freedom in what perhaps had been a sentence of imprisonment where you felt, oh my God, I'm becoming like them, because they are changing themselves.
I'm reading a little passage here from Julia Pandle. She writes in Memoir of the Sunday Brunch, "Our parents are planted everywhere in us, their smiles, their gait, their stomachs, their habits. The older we get, the stronger the roots." She says, "In time, we become what we said we never would. We become them, and we smile in spite of ourselves." And I wonder, Vanessa, I don't know if you, in your therapy work, if you think about self-realization, if you do, how much of that is becoming an independent actor in the world, independent from perhaps our parents, and how much is coming to terms with the fact that they're just going to be within us, whatever our self-realization.
I think it's a bit of both. I think being able to be conscious about it, I think, and that's why sometimes it takes, while therapy can be helpful, it's like, tell us about these people. I'll oftentimes do a genogram, which is, tell me about your family. What is the story of your family? What's the legacy of your family? And which are the parts that you want to keep? Mm-hmm. And which are the parts that maybe need to be composted and turned into something slightly different because they're no longer useful and maybe bordering on toxic. And especially when I talk to people who have had intense trauma, mm-hmm. those damaging experiences, I think that when it's possible, and it's always an incredible moment where someone who has only had stories that are all nightmarish, and they suddenly see a flicker of their parents' humanity in some story maybe of their childhood. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes I'll ask people to go back to remember parents before, you know, sort of getting information before they became parents about the whole experience of their lives. That doesn't mean you have to sort of write off damage done, but you do want to understand is the complexity. And so I'm really big on having people often audio tape or videotape now, but oftentimes with elders you have to audio tape it because they mm-hmm. won't sit in front of a camera.
Right.
But I think sometimes you hear in those stories something that gives you more compassion or a piece of, aha, that's where that sort of maybe that harshness or even that gentleness came from.
Right.
And I think the more we understand the stories, the more we have more choice about how we want to live out that particular story.
I mean, James, the warmth, the welcome quality in your rumination on your similarities to your father, it does feel like it comes from, or is possible in part, because there seems, reading you here, that there's some fundamental gentleness in your father that
Absolutely.
You were not abused. Many are. You were not, run from pillar to post by your dad, and so. It's an open path, maybe not one you immediately embrace when you're young, but older doesn't seem wrong to take a bit of it.
No, a lot of love and gentleness, and I think for me the struggle was separating the humane qualities which are absolutely there in my parents from this rather austere religious upbringing, mm-hmm. where I wasn't always able to feel that humanity being spoken. And I think now, in middle age, as I look at them in their 80s, I'm actually finally putting the two together. I'm not myself a believer, but I can see that, for instance, in the way they sort of calm with which they approach death,
mm-hmm.
The way in which they are very involved in, you know, church community, they go mm-hmm. to other people's funerals.
The way they're fortified by
yeah,
all that. Maybe.
It's a strength for them, mm-hmm. And I can see what's good and fine about it.
It is an insight that comes to everybody sooner or later, and with little luck, we can embrace some of it and learn from it. James Wood with The New Yorker. Staff writer for The New Yorker is with us. Vanessa Jackson, therapist from Atlanta, Georgia, is here. This is Lauren Elena, Like My Mother Does. She was an American Idol runner-up. It's from her 2011 album, Wildflower. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about that sense that we all or most get sometime, my gosh, I'm turning into my parents, my mother, my father, the way they are or were. James Wood is with us. He's got a wonderful essay on it in the current issue of The New Yorker, teaches at Harvard, essayist, novelist, literary critic, joins me in the studio today. Vanessa Jackson is with us from Atlanta, Georgia. Social worker there, therapist. Her practice is called Healing Circle. She does a lot of research on power within families. And as always, our listeners bring a lot to this. Gerald writes us online, James, Vanessa. He says, I think many among us become our parents to the extent that we really know of no other way of dealing with children. When that comes up, we raise children as our parents did. He hasn't had children. And he says he read Philip Larkin's This Be the Verse when he was very young. And he quotes from it. He says this is cleaned up a little bit to protect the delicate ears of those who have never heard English cursing. Who among us, I wonder, but still. And let me read, and thank you for this, Gerald. Quoting Philip Larkin's poem here. They screw you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had and add some extra just for you. But they were screwed up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin with a pretty definite view that they screwed up your mom and dad.
He kept to it, too. He didn't have any kids.
Yeah, and yet they're the scaffolding we have to build on from early.
Yes, and I think the power of that poem is in part, it's double, isn't it? It's part because it's an actual cry of rage, and I kept to it, I didn't have kids, I got out.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it's the other side too, which is it's a deliberately exaggerated anger.
Yes.
So that you feel all that he hasn't had and wasn't able to have because he's trapped in this feeling that man simply hands on despair as opposed to, say, love.
Yeah. And so yet we can't all not have kids or that's the end, end of the show.
Right.
And when we do, sympathy to us all because we'll grab on to what we grab on to. Donna in Springfield, Illinois is calling. Donna, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I lost my father about a year ago, and I've caught myself lately really listening to like 1940s music. Mm-hmm. Which he listened to. It's kind of freaking me out that I'm doing this.
What are you listening to, Donna? What's on your turntable? You're in your CD on your playlist.
I got Sirius on the radio in my car, and I'm listening to the 1940s.
Yeah.
You know, mainly big band Artie Shaw music that I liked okay, but.
Do you feel like your father's in your passenger seat when you turn that on, or in the back seat driving you?
It. It does remind me so much of him.
That's something. Maybe it brings it back. I mean, I'm sorry you lost your dad, but maybe that fills a void a little bit. It certainly did for James Wood when he put back on the Beethoven string quartets. Savannah, Georgia, Isaac is calling. Isaac, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When I was in the early 20s, someone gave me a copy of The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell.
Sure.
And I was struck by his discussion of Star Wars. And I remember seeing that when I was a boy and being horrified when he had struck down Darth Vader and it turned out to be himself. And then when he later developed the bionic hand, I was a very angry young man when I was growing up. And then whenever I saw that symbol, it made me aware of two things, that despite yourself, you are becoming partly your parents because you are your parents, but also that rebellion and anger can sometimes make you become the thing that you do not want to be.
Yes, or maybe a model to go another way. I mean, Vanessa, if I'm not wrong, you did some modeling in opposition with your own father.
You know, I did both of them because one of the things I want to, if I can speak to Donna's point, because she's actually from my hometown, Springfield, Illinois,
Yeah.
But that music stuff, one of the things my father gave me a gift. I lost my mother in 2008, and my father gave me a gift as we were sort of sitting around the kitchen, and he said, and I told him, I always thought my love of country music came from him. He goes, oh, no, I didn't like that. He goes, your mom loved that music. And so Patsy Cline, Crazy, was her favorite song. And so I went out and got him a CD of it, which it was too painful for him to listen to. Yeah. But that sense about her presence when her song, the song that she loved before I knew her, does offer me something different. So that's one piece. The other thing is like resisting my father, who could be kind of rageful when I was a child, and then realizing how to transform that into something else. Because now I was talking to someone, I said, you know, I'm not afraid of anger because I got to see it early on. And so I'm not as overwhelmed by it. And so when I'm often talking to women about working with anger and they're afraid of letting it loose and that kind of stuff, I said, I've seen it. You know, it's you know, we can all get over it. And I want to figure out my way of holding anger. So my father's negative sort of message actually then was transformed into something that I had to be in my 40s before I recognized the gift of it. And so one of the things... Yeah, so I ask people to sort of look for the gift in it. It's a wound maybe, but there's a gift that we have the power to transform.
They teach us about the architecture of the world, even when it may not be the architecture we want to build on, James.
Right.
Absolutely right. I was struck by Donna's thing, too, about listening to music in grief, because one of the reasons I wrote this piece was that I was coming back to a wonderful story that I'd read a few years earlier, but not quite made full sense of, a little fragment by Lydia Davis called How Shall I Mourn Them?
Yes.
Which is just a series of questions. And the questions go like this. Shall I keep a tidy house like L? Shall I develop an unsanitary habit like K? Shall I sway from side to side a little as I walk like C? Shall I write letters to the editor like R? Shall I retire to my room often during the day like R? And it continues. And I wrote about it a few years ago and said I think this is about watching friends mourn their parents and develop certain tics in their mourning. But it wasn't until a friend of mine said, isn't it also about those tics being one's parents' tics? And this friend of mine said, you know, I didn't like gardening until my mother died. She was a great gardener. And then after she died, I suddenly became obsessed with gardening. And so she alerted me, I think, to the way in which that story is also about not simply developing certain habits of grief, but how those habits of grief might well be the exact parental habits that you are copying.
Is she gardening because she suddenly realized she had that longing, or is she gardening in homage? She wants to, as a kind of honor to her past mother?
I'm not entirely sure. I think at a certain point in middle age, as I say in the piece, this becoming them might be both a welcome and a farewell, right? You're welcoming them, and you're also preparing for the next stage, which is, I mean, either they're on their way or they're actually dead, but the next stage, which is you becoming them and also dying.
Kind of bridging, sort of opening your eyes to just what is. Hunter in Virginia Beach. Virginia, Hunter, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom. Hi. I physically resemble my father to a frightening degree.
Okay.
And I found that influenced my behavior because people, acquaintances who've met him, will expect me to act like him. And I was wondering if that is a unique trend, or is that something that is common as far as physical appearance guiding behavior?
I mean, I don't know how to actually answer it, except that, Vanessa, James, we do get physical characteristics from our parents. Physical characteristics can shape, in some ways, how the world responds to us, the certain cast of our brow that the world sees and responds to. The world may greet us in some ways as it greeted our parents just because of how we manifest physically, James. It seems possible.
Yeah, perfectly.
Maybe something in the way we move, maybe something in our facial expression.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I think Vanessa probably has more experience of this than I do.
What do you think, Vanessa?
I think the thing of it is important is people expect. And I think it's really about that sort of creation of the story in that direction versus if I look like my father, then people expect certain things, certain temperaments. And when we show up with some of our own uniqueness, then there is that sort of interaction that becomes like, and which also triggers, I got to be my own person. And so that can sort of push some of the rebellion because, and that sense of like, I get to be me, and yes, I wear my father's face, sort of, but that I still want you to see the uniqueness of that is me, and I think oftentimes when we can get to the place where we sort of establish this is me, then I could start to bring in those other traits, but I think there's almost sometimes the tyranny of be my own person, and I would also sort of say there's probably maybe a slight cultural flavor about that, where there's more, you're more in a sort of culture where the collective value is very is highly valued. Becoming one's parent is not nearly that same awful thing.
It may be welcomed. You may be seen as carrying a lineage or something
exactly.
in that way. I mean, I was struck as well. James found himself kind of slipping into his father's slippers musically at a certain age. But it doesn't have to be that way. A man at a certain age may find that he is feeling like he's become his mother, a woman like she's become her father. You must have seen that as well, Vanessa. It's hardly as though you naturally go into the same gender role necessarily. It may be the other, the opposite gender parent that leaves that imprint.
I think we're influenced by all parents, and certainly people who are raising same-sex couples are being influenced by all their parents. And so not to get locked in the gender roles, but to say you look around, they're our world for the first, you know, 3-4 years of our life, absolutely our world. And so we look to them, and then we start to sort of take in that stuff, the stuff that works, and then the stuff, because really when we first hear, how old were you when you first heard, you're just like your ex, you're just like your mother, you're just like your father. And oftentimes, the first time you hear it, it's not a positive.
if you hear it from the other parent.
It's like you're just like your dad. No one said like, oh, so loving and gentle and wonderful. It's usually like, you know, you're messy like that, you're argumentative. Right. And so we're always sort of taking in all this information and then trying to construct a stable narrative about who we are. And when we can sort of take and be conscious about it and say, okay, these are the pieces that I really like. This other stuff over here, it's not working for him or her. I don't think I want to carry it. There's a psychologist that I read when I was 16 trying to figure out like my sort of interesting family. And I remember reading it thinking, he said, Jess Laird is his name. He says, for what you are, shame on your parents. But if you stay that way, shame on yourself.
Yes.
And I'm not really big on shaming. I don't want to encourage people to be shamed. But that sense about, like, I have choice. What I heard in that is I have choice about how to live this out. And as I get older, then I can begin to think about the stuff that I value about who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pieces that I know I have to transform because they no longer serve me. And they probably don't even serve our family system.
We have choice. On the other hand, that can end up like feeling like some kind of false bottom suitcase. You think you have choice, and then boom, there they are again, or there they are in you again, and we realize the limits of choice.
Make peace with, and that's the other piece of it, is you make peace with it.
Yeah.
You just make peace with it, because, you know, and say the gift of it. It's like, I can find the gift of this. And if I can ask James a question, because one of the things he talked about the music box that stood out for me is, as parents are aging and they're starting to clock their remaining time, that sometimes a thing like, oh, I won't buy that because it's, you know, it's not a good investment if I only have 3 more years left.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there thinking like, buy the box or whatever.
Why paint the house, for heaven's sakes?
Exactly. But then it creates oftentimes anxiety in us because they're ready to talk about checking out.
Yeah.
And as our and we're not. And we miss some really important conversations. And that's what I would want to say is, don't miss these really important conversations because we get scared of losing them.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had people say, oh, well, if my parents die, this is going to happen to me. It's like, what if? Like, are they immortals? But that just shows how deep the denial is.
Yes.
And so it's like, if we can take these opportunities to talk about their transition and their legacy and what they're afraid of and what they're not afraid of, I think there's great things they can teach us about the living until you die process.
Maybe, James, when you put on the Beethoven string quartet these days, maybe there's a way in which you are preparing to bridge beyond your father's eventual passing. You'll carry that in yourself. And in that way, he won't be entirely gone. Maybe there's some comfort in that.
I think that's very, very shrewd. And I think music, along with literature and the other arts, but perhaps particularly music, allows us to think of something permanent, continuing after a death.
Yes.
It's made by a composer. It outlived the composer.
It can be played again and again. It can be played by different hands, but it's still the music.
And it's why I think music is obviously so central to funerals and memorial services. It's not just because people, you know, put on sad things to make themselves cry in a church or a synagogue or whatever. It's because I think there is, it's part of a liturgical permanence that goes on. I'm also struck by how often Vanessa has mentioned the word narrative.
A stable narrative of who we are. Good luck with that.
I think that's so important. I have a relatively unreflective sibling, and I would say that one central difference between us is I have a propensity to reflect in narrative and on narrative, and therefore...
You're a writer.
Right, and therefore to see around and behind my parents in that fundamentally forgiving way that Vanessa mm-hmm. was talking mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. right? You get beyond condemnation, mm-hmm. and you see them, I think, you know, Chekhov said, wisely said, you know, I'm not about condemning the horse thief, I'm just about writing, I'm going to write a story about the horse thief. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big part of maturity, of seeing what was good and bad about one's parents.
An awareness of what is real, that they are in us, they will be in us, elements of them, and a kind of compassion for them and ourselves in that
yeah,
realization.
And even as you write a narrative, as it were, about them, to realize that they were caught in a narrative, just as you're caught in a narrative. I mean, they, you know, they had as little freedom as you might feel, right? Just as you might feel, hey, a great deal of this is prescripted and written for me, mm-hmm. alas. So they did. They just didn't talk about it.
If compassion is important to Vanessa, it seems to live right here, right in this realization.
You know, it's absolutely one of the things that occurred to me, and I was early in my 20s and I figured this out. I said, I am my mother's unfulfilled potential. And I thought that was very powerful because I got to do things she could never do because of just timing and everything. Mm. So I'm grateful for that.
And yet, no doubt, built in no small part on the frame that your mother offered you.
Yes, absolutely.
This has been really a delight. And James Wood, we appreciate you sharing your sense of your father and your family in print and with us here today. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
James Wood teaches at Harvard, writes for The New Yorker. Look up his piece, Becoming Them, Our Parents, Ourselves. And Vanessa Jackson in Atlanta, Georgia, our wonderful wise therapist there. Vanessa, thank you very much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Share your stories at the On Point website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.